The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Well, President Obama was in Germany yesterday and the day before that, I believe. And he's there calling for a much stronger, more unified Europe. How significant is this? Prophetically, he's calling on Europe to arm themselves, to up their defense spending, to share in the burden, to shoulder those burdens for defense spending. And he's also there in Europe to open up free trade lanes with the continent, or at least asking for that or calling upon that free trade agreement between the European Union and the United States. This first comment here is something he said on Sunday in Hanover, Germany.
Finally, in this time of uncertainty, including here in Europe, when others would use trade and energy as a weapon, TTIP would help Europe diversify energy markets and increase energy security.
When others would use trade as a weapon, he said. He said this just 2 days after he told Britain that they were going to the back of the queue on trade if they left the European Union. We played this clip for you yesterday.
I think it's fair to say that maybe some point down the line there might be a UK-US trade agreement, but it's not going to happen anytime soon because our focus is in negotiating with a big bloc, the European Union, to get a trade agreement done. And UK is going to be in the back of the queue.
The back of the queue, President Obama said on Friday. And then to reinforce that, on Saturday, the next day, the president told BBC just how long a go-it-alone Britain might have to wait in line.
It could be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, before we were able to actually get something done.
So if Britain leaves, it could be 5 or 10 years before they can reach any kind of a trade deal with the United States. That's the United States. That's the president of the U.S. threatening the U.K. with trade war, basically, using trade as a weapon. And then he's off to Germany after leaving the U.K., talking about those who would use trade as a weapon, and that's why the United States and the European Union need to work together. You can see why so many in Britain are so upset. For the longest time, the Leave campaign here in the UK, they've firmly believed that the connection they have with the United States and with the Commonwealth nations around the world was a much stronger and more natural bond than anything that they could have with Europe. The fundamental values are similar. Their laws flow from the same tradition. It would be a better alliance for Britain to reach out to the United States. A stronger alliance than the one Britain currently has with Europe. But the big problem with this is we've seen now very clearly over the last few days is that the United States, at least under the present leadership of Barack Obama, the United States doesn't want that. They don't want a stronger relationship with Britain. The United States, you could say, is more pro-European than even many of the nations in Europe are. As Richard Palmer said in an article a few years ago, America views Britain as a bridge to Europe rather than an important ally in its own right. And so if Britain leaves, then, as President Obama has made clear, its usefulness to America is over. Well, they might as well get into the back of the queue. The president even used the British term. Get right in the back of the queue, and you could wait 5 or 10 years. It could be 5 or 10 years, because negotiating a trade agreement is so difficult. It's so hard to come to an agreement on free trade. 5 or 10 years. There are quite a few commentators in the UK now writing about whether or not this is going to backfire on the president. And again, as I said yesterday, who knows how the referendum is going to unfold here. But we'll know in a couple of months. But what's significant, as I got into yesterday, is this special relationship that's no longer very special. And scriptures like the ones I went through yesterday, Isaiah 9, Zechariah 11, Hosea 5, that talk about the sickness of our nations. And how that right here at the end, we're going to be devouring one another, fighting against each other, brothers, family members fighting. And that's what we're seeing. The Spectator, just the other day, wrote this: Barack Obama's decision to visit Britain during an election campaign was controversial enough. His writing an article against Brexit in the Daily Telegraph was more controversial still. But to stand in Downing Street and then threaten his host country with being dumped at the back of the queue for trade talks should it choose to leave the EU is, I think, too much. It's precisely the comment that could backfire and spark indignation and make people ask, who on earth is Obama to come to Britain to speak to us in this way? Who does he think he is? And that's what so many are saying. In recent years, the article continues, when America has come looking for allies to help with heavy lifting in Iraq and Afghanistan, Britain was there. Most of Europe wasn't. When diplomatic heavy lifting needed to be done in Obama's deal with Iran, Britain was there, backing him to the hilt. Even though Iranians have been responsible for the deaths of British servicemen, the heavy lifting that Britain has been doing for the U.S. in the name of liberty has been as much, often more, than our shrinking military could bear. But we did it because that's what allies are for. That's what allies are for, the Spectator says. Yes, Britain may have answered when the White House called in its time of need, but should we choose to leave the EU and make our own way in the world by striking new alliances, we'd find ourselves relegated to the back of the queue. We're told that Obama has been here to be a candid friend, and he has certainly been candid. But is this really the language of a friend? Is this really the language of a friend? You get to the back of the line. Here the president visits the UK for a couple of days. And he talked a lot about the so-called special relationship. So did Prime Minister Cameron. I think between the two of them, they used that term more than a dozen times during the president's visit to the UK. But as I asked yesterday, what are the fruits? What have been the fruits? And who is it now that's threatening to use trade as a weapon should the UK decide to leave the EU? Who's using trade as a weapon? And then how significant is it that for his grand address to the people of Europe, President Obama chose to give that in Germany yesterday? not while he was here in the UK. President Obama, the United States, it looks to Germany as the leader, as the powerhouse. So he comes to the UK and he scolds Britain. And then he heads off to Germany to tell the people of Europe how important the Union is, how strong it is, how much stronger it should be. Politico had a piece about the U.S.-UK special relationship and how that it's in decline. I mean, how can anyone not see this? Just because you say special relationship 12 times doesn't mean it's very special. Even Politico, a left-leaning publication from the U.S., is pointing out the obvious. It says here, when Obama wants to crank up pressure on Russian President Vladimir Putin, he calls German Chancellor Angela Merkel. It was then French President Nicolas Sarkozy who persuaded him to bomb Libya in 2011. There's a big difference between Obama's relationship with the UK and that of predecessors like George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Ronald Reagan, said James Rubin, a former State Department spokesman. In the past, the special relationship had a more powerful impact on international relations. Definitely, Rubin said. I mean, it was very different in the past. These two, and you even saw it. I gave you that quote yesterday from Ron Fraser. That relationship between Tony Blair and George Bush, not exactly political allies, but they came together in a moment of crisis. They worked together. There was a special bond, and that was like the swan song, as Mr. Fraser pointed out. And look at where it is today. Politico says Obama aides insist that the rising influence of Germany and France doesn't make Britain any less important to the U.S. Or the relationship any less special. Yet an implied point of Obama's call for Britain to reject a proposed exit from the European Union is that the country isn't significant enough to remain a key U.S. partner if it's no longer part of the EU. That's Politico talking about the implied point that the president was making on Friday. That if you go it alone, you're not significant enough anymore. You've got to be in the EU. You've got to be in this big power block. Liam Fox, a conservative member of parliament and former British defense minister, told the BBC on Friday that Obama was threatening to give America's special friend a punishment beating if it makes the wrong choice. Yes, sir. That's what unfolded over the weekend, as we played for you yesterday. Politico says analysts on both sides of the Atlantic admit that Britain's strategic importance to Washington has ebbed thanks to London's waning economic clout and its steadily contracting military. Well, I mean, Britain needs to look at itself, too, in all of this. Look at its decline. Look at its waning economic clout. And look at the contracting military. These ought to be setting off alarm bells in Parliament at 10 Downing Street, but it doesn't. The U.S.-UK special relationship is in decline, wrote Xenia Wickett, head of the U.S. and America's program at the London think tank, Chatham House. What is clear, this is quoting her, what is clear is that increasingly the UK is not first among equals in Europe, but one among many for the United States. And really, I mean, that's what President Obama said he wanted from the get-go. Everybody's on an equal playing field, whether it's Iran or Britain. No one, I mean, Britain's not any more special than any other nation, Greece or whoever. You remember those from those statements from early on in his presidency. No longer first among equals, but one among many. Politico talks about that Atlantic piece from a few weeks back, published last month, I guess it was, where Obama cited the British Parliament's refusal to back his proposed 2013 airstrikes on Syria as a key factor in his decision to abort the attack. It was Britain's fault. It was Parliament's fault. They wouldn't get behind Mr. Cameron. And so, well, I reconsidered, and now I'm glad I did, but, you know, if you go back to root causes, you can pin the blame on Britain. It says further, Obama went further, The Atlantic reported, breaking a core diplomatic taboo by telling Cameron privately that the special relationship would be in danger if Britain didn't boost its contribution to NATO. That's what the United States did. It threatened. It threatened that the special relationship would be in danger if Britain didn't boost its contributions to NATO. And so it did, and most of the others in Europe didn't. And yet still, here comes the United States. Here comes the president on Friday and says, you better stay in the EU or you go to the back of the line. And I mean, it could be 5 or 10 years before we ever get this sorted out. You're just too small and powerless. You're tiny. We can't bother to deal with you on an individual level. Forget about the history. Forget about anything special that was once there between us. One threat after another. Even Libya, if you look at that Atlantic article, the president wanted to put some of the blame for that nightmare, on leaders in Europe, including Prime Minister Cameron. The Daily Mail, talking about the threats coming from the U.S. president, encouraged the people of Britain to make up their own mind. It says here, from your people shall be my people to back of the queue in one brutal move. Obama was issuing a cold-blooded threat to Britain because he believes it's in America's interests for us to remain in the EU. Well, for one thing, our relationship with America hasn't been all that special anyway since Obama came to power. As he admitted, we played this for you yesterday too, one of his first acts as president was to remove from the Oval Office, the bust of Churchill that Tony Blair had presented to George W. Bush. That was one of his first acts as president. And that was something, as I said yesterday, the White House denied and denied and denied, saying we didn't have anything to do with it. And then the president, he finally chooses this moment, his visit to the UK, when he uses trade as a weapon to threaten Britain, and then tells them, oh, by the way, I did remove that bust, and I think some of you happen to agree with me on that. It says here, this is the Daily Mail, when America asked for Britain's help in its war on terror in 2003, Blair did not tell Bush to go to the back of the queue. Ouch. On the contrary, we jeopardized our international reputation to stand shoulder to shoulder with the U.S. then, as we had done for 75 years. But that meant little to the incoming president. To underline just how a low opinion he had of Britain, Obama said in 2010 that America would be neutral when it came to Argentina and the Falklands. It's just as well he wasn't in the White House when Argentina invaded in 1982. Well, Argentina, they're on an equal playing field, you have to understand. There's nothing special about Britain, at least not in any sense that it's better than Argentina or that the alliance is stronger than the one with Argentina or Turkey or Greece or Iran. That's the thinking. It's been that way from the beginning. And so we see all of these strong alliances that go back 75 years, even farther than that, as I said yesterday. It's actually rooted in Bible prophecy and Bible history. All these alliances All of these strong ties, we just see them unraveling, one after another. Even as the United States helps to prop up and to empower these ascendant powers, whether it's Iran or, as we'll see in the next segment, the European Union. Why so much love and affection for the European Union? And nothing but slaps in the face. Well, worse than that, blatant threats when it comes to that very special relationship that goes back 75 years and then some. This is from a website, capx.co. It says, which brings us to, picking it up in the middle of a thought here, which brings us on to Britain's own attempt to recapture ultimate control over our sovereignty from the European Union, faced with the knowledge that foreign judges sitting in Europe and elsewhere can overrule, and in 70 cases since 1996 have indeed overruled our own courts, including the Supreme Court. The British people are finally staging their own uprising. The British Spring, it says. Well, this is something the United States would surely get behind and support, given its support for so many of the uprisings in the Middle East. It says it should therefore come as no surprise that President Obama has lost no opportunity to come to London this week to try to stymie it. His actions are totally consistent with the central theme of his entire presidency, namely, to support governments against people and establishments against democratic uprisings wherever he finds them. He stands in direct opposition to the longest and proudest tradition of the U.S. presidency, and the British people should treat with derision his counsels on this issue, as on so many others. And so those are a few samplings of the reaction to the president's visit to the U.K., and the trip, as we'll cover here in the next segment. It continued on from here down into Germany, where the President of the United States made some very interesting and revealing comments. We'll get to that coming up next. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at the trumpet.com website and at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Did it ever strike you as most unusual that the great God should have raised up the ancient nation Israel to be his chosen people? Consider these seemingly paradoxical facts. God says he is not a respecter of persons. Is he then a respecter of nations? Does he have a favorite? Did you ever realize that God denied his chosen people salvation, save only their prophets? That the chosen nation was given only material and national promises? That God's Holy Spirit was inaccessible to them? The Holy Bible is indeed a book that is primarily about one people, the people of Israel. But why? This astounding truth is a mystery totally unknown by any religion, by Christianity, by even Judaism. It is thoroughly explained in this book, Mystery of the Ages. It is an intriguing story. The mystery of Israel has great significance in God's purpose for all peoples. One cannot understand the real purpose and incredible potential of man without this vital knowledge. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
With respect to the U.S.-German relationship and my relationship with Chancellor Merkel, I've said this before, I will repeat. This is as important a relationship as I've had during the course of my presidency.
Chancellor Merkel has been consistent. She has been steady. She is trustworthy.
That's a very special relationship. The United States and Germany. It's an interesting and revealing contrast, isn't it? When you see the way the U.S. president treats Britain. And then compare that with Germany, particularly when you consider prophecies like we read, I believe it was last week, Jeremiah 30, about America's lovers reaching out to our lovers, and yet, as the Bible prophesies, there's going to be a double cross in the end. Those lovers are going to forget all about us. But when you look at the world today, I mean, love is in the air. You see how President Obama and Angela Merkel, for that matter, the way they talk to each other. And yet, when you look at what's actually happening on the ground, of course, there's a lot of people very dissatisfied with President Obama's administration. He didn't get quite the reception he did back in 2008, if you remember that one. 200,000 people turned out for a speech that President Obama gave, or then-Senator Obama gave, in Germany. And so he returns to Germany Sunday and Monday, and he raves about Germany's power and about the rise of Europe. This next one here, let's just skip one, Sam, and go to clip number 6.
So I've come here today to the heart of Europe to say that the United States and the entire world needs a strong and prosperous and democratic and united Europe.
That's from his speech in Hanover, Germany, that he gave yesterday. He's there in the heart of Europe, saying that the world needs a strong and prosperous, united Europe. We've made the point often before how that with these emerging powers, these prophesied blocks of power, how that the United States, in many cases, is largely responsible for empowering these movements, or at the very least, for clearing the way for these movements to gain strength. He goes back and covers some of the history of U.S. Support for Europe, the rebuilding effort since the end of the Second World War. This is clip 7.
But from the ruins of the Second World War, our nation set out to remake the world, to build a new international order and the institutions to uphold it. A United Nations to prevent another world war and advance a more just and lasting peace. International financial institutions like a World Bank and an International Monetary Fund to promote prosperity for all peoples. A Universal Declaration of Human Rights to advance the inalienable rights of all members of the human family. And here in Europe, giants like Chancellor Adenauer set out to bind old adversaries through commerce and through trade. As Adenauer said in those early days, European unity was a dream of a few. It became a hope for the many. Today, it is a necessity for all of us.
Now, who was it that was talking about this dream for Europe way back in the 1940s and 50s? Who was it that was telling us, that was preparing us for the emergence of this developing superpower? He touches on some important history there and talks about also some organizations like the UN that have been just abysmal failures, but leave that aside. He sees all of this as just a remarkable sign of progress. We've played clips for you before about just the way he views the world today. In fact, I have one that we'll hopefully get to later. Just how awesome the world is, how safe it is, how prosperous it is. And listen, when you see what he's saying on Sunday and then again yesterday, he, as I said at the start, I mean, he's more pro-European than many in Europe are. He wants them to gain in strength. He wants them to build up their military. He wants their alliance to get stronger. He's even going so far as threatening Britain should they decide to step out of it. This next one is also from that same speech in Hanover, clip 8.
With strength and resolve and the power of our ideals and a belief in a unified Europe, we didn't simply end the Cold War. Freedom won. Germany was reunited. You welcomed new democracies into an even ever closer union. You may argue over whose football clubs are better, vote for different singers on Eurovision, but your accomplishment, more than 500 million people speaking 24 languages in 28 countries, 19 with a common currency, in one European Union, remains one of the greatest political and economic achievements of modern times.
That's quite a statement there at the end. I mean, there he is throwing his full weight of support behind the rise of the Holy Roman Empire. That's what's prophesied. I mean, when have you heard him say things like what he just said there about other nations or groups? Well, one thing's for sure. I mean, he's pro-union, whatever it is. If it's a union of these peoples or these nations or these groups, it's always going to be a good thing. When in fact, all of these efforts by men and human organizations to unify, to come together, they always end up being a spectacular failure. That's the truth. The United Nations is proof of that. But even some of the what you would think would be much better examples. Look at the United States. Look at what's happening to the United States. Is it united? Well, the founder said the only way it's going to stay together is if the people, for the most part, remain religious and moral, morally upright. Europe, the European Union, it's had its share of problems. And we know it's prophesied to be dramatically revised, downsized. And even that newer, stronger Europe that's coming, it's going to be very short-lived. The Bible tells us this in the book of Revelation. Short while. In fact, we can just look at that. If you want to read along in your Bible, these are verses that we've discussed quite often on this program. This is Revelation 17 and verse 13 says, "These have one mind and shall give their power and strength to the beast." They're going to give their power and strength to the beast. If you back up, verse 12 says, "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast." 1 hour of power. And they're going to cause a lot of destruction during that hour. 10 of them, though. So we know it's going to be smaller in the end. It's not going to be 28 countries with 19 of them in the common currency. It's going to be whittled down to 10 groups. Or 10 kings, 10 leaders. And it's going to be headed up by Germany. That's going to be the power. Together, of course, with the Vatican. That'll be the spiritual guidance that union needs. This next clip here also comes from the president. In his address to, this is the title he gave it on his White House website, "The Address to the People of Europe. This is from Hanover, Germany, just yesterday. Clip 9.
And today, more than ever, a strong, united Europe remains, as Adenauer said, a necessity for all of us. It's a necessity for the United States because Europe's security and prosperity is inherently indivisible from our own. We can't cut ourselves off from you. Our economies are integrated. Our cultures are integrated. Our peoples are integrated. You saw the response of the American people to Paris and Brussels. It's because, in our imaginations, this is our cities. A strong, united Europe is a necessity for the world because an integrated Europe remains vital to our international order. Europe helps to uphold the norms and rules that can maintain peace and promote prosperity around the world.
And so the United States is really lending its support in a strong way, the strongest imaginable way, to bring about this empire. It's being encouraged to come together. Germany is being encouraged by the United States to take the lead. The nations in Europe are being encouraged to step up defense spending. This is what he said here. He corrected me. If there was one corrective statement in the speech, it was that each of those nations in Europe need to be paying more for their common security.
And that's why every NATO member should be contributing its full share, 2% of GDP, towards our common security. Something that doesn't always happen. And I'll be honest, sometimes Europe has been complacent about its own defense.
That's amazing. That's amazing. He's calling for Europe to arm themselves. He's calling on Europe to take matters into their own hands. And Europe's about to do that. Again, what will this June referendum trigger? What will be the outcome? And could that be the trigger that really kicks things into the high gear? He said also in that speech yesterday that our countries are stronger, they're more secure, they're more successful when we integrate together. And then as he went on to say, when we open the doors to people of all backgrounds and faith, he's talking there about just letting them. This is why he's step in step with Miss Merkel, because he, like she is, I mean, he's there opening the doors for anyone and everyone to come on in. And so he's encouraging Europeans to come together and to get stronger and to also admit unlimited numbers of immigrants, which, of course, many Europeans, including many in Germany, are very much against. You may have seen the news just from yesterday or the day before about the Austrian elections. Again, these far-right groups, these nationalist groups that are gaining in popularity, that are gaining momentum. Even as the president goes in and talks about everyone coming together and welcoming in all the migrants. It's a crazy worldview in so many ways. But so much of it, I mean, he doesn't even understand what he's wishing for, what he's hoping for. He doesn't understand these prophecies, like what we just read in Revelation 17, and where this is all leading. And I'll play just one last quote for you. This is a little bit off topic, but this is another one from his speech yesterday in Hanover.
For a lot of years, it was thought that countries had to choose between economic growth and economic inclusion. Now we know the truth. When wealth is increasingly concentrated among the few at the top, it's not only a moral challenge to us, but it actually drags down a country's growth potential. We need growth that is broad and lifts everybody up.
And so those are pretty common talking points coming from those on the far left. But what's astounding is that here he's been reaching out to Cuba and other nations like that, where there has been wealth at the very top. And that's it. You know, a few billionaires in the midst of this sea of poverty. The same could be said for Venezuela. And these are the nations that this president really reaches out to in a special kind of way. And of course, in the United States, I mean, here he's been in power over 7 years. And we've seen this disparity just worsen between the rich and the poor, I mean. And yet the talking points continue. Let's just fix all of this by adding more social programs. I mean, he went to Europe and he said, I'm happy to report that we have universal health care in the United States. Never mind the facts on the ground. Never mind the rising costs. Never mind the debt. Just add another social program and everything will get quite a lot better. Well, let's just step back from all of this, these clips, and look at this fascinating article here. One of the better ones that we've seen on Europe, the Union, and the impact that the United Kingdom leaving the Union could have. It's going to happen at some point, whether it's in June or not. It will happen. Mr. Armstrong talked about this decades ago, and we've been repeating it over and over and over to prepare you for it. And what makes this article so fascinating is that it does a pretty good job of explaining how Britain's departure could impact the European Union. I mean, already you have the special relationship unraveling between the UK and America. Already you have the United States, the world's lone superpower, supposedly, providing its full support for Europe to come together and to get stronger, to rise up, to defend themselves, to increase defense spending. Well, this Bloomberg View piece, it says here the UK is the biggest defense spender in the Union with 21% of the bloc's total military budget and one of very few NATO countries that fulfill their commitment to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on military programs. So they're one of the few that's fulfilling its obligation, its commitment, the UK, that is. Without the UK, the EU will be far less protected, and its members would either have to raise spending dramatically or depend even more on the US than they do now. That would hand extra leverage to the United States and mitigate the loss of the special relationship as an EU-oriented policy instrument. So in other words, if the UK is gone, and along with its 21% contribution to NATO, to the total military budget, well, then you have a continent that's all the more dependent on the United States. And you've had leadership in the United States that's all the more happy to support that union, to back that union, to enter into trade agreements with that union. It says here, this is Bloomberg View, all in all, the EU's losses from Brexit would be easily manageable. It's likely, I'm skipping over a few thoughts here, it says, it's likely that the momentous event would bring the remaining EU members closer, ultimately contributing to the creation of a truly borderless market that as a unit would be more competitive with other global economic powers. The relationship with the U.S. would probably balance itself after a while, and a solution would be found to the defense issue. Ultimately, the key point here, ultimately, it would bring the nations in the EU, the EU members, closer together. And then Bloomberg says this, there is, however, one problem that might prove harder to mitigate in the long run, that of Germany's uncontested dominance. Germany's preponderance in the EU has grown in the past 5 years because of the disengagement of the UK. So, in other words, as the UK has disengaged, Germany has filled the void, and the United States is encouraging this. The United States is supporting this. It says here, the relative weakness. Well, let me just read that thought again. Germany's preponderance in the EU has grown in the past 5 years because of the disengagement of the UK, the relative weakness of both France and the European Commission, the Center for European Reform report says. And then finally, Germany's leadership is, to a degree, forced and reluctant without the UK's spirited opposition. Its role will be institutionalized. Even if the Union becomes closer as a result, there are likely to be more policy errors and more resentment against Germany as the driving force, an attitude that is already widespread in Southern and Eastern Europe. Sometimes a strong dissenting force can be beneficial to a group. And that's probably the biggest reason why the EU should hope to avoid Brexit. That's the biggest reason why we should hope to avoid Brexit. Because with the UK in, with Britain in the Union, you have a strong dissenting force. You have a power that can neutralize Germany. But once the UK is on the outside, well, you can expect for that union to get closer and for Germany to become that much more dominant. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream is at our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The indescribable wreckage of the Second World War left hundreds of thousands of civilians in Germany wandering around helplessly, hungry and homeless. Every major city in Germany was buried under a heap of ruin. Adding insult to these devastating injuries, the United States and Britain jointly stated, "It is our inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and Nazism, and to ensure that Germany will never again be able to disturb the peace of the world." Germany had just received one of the worst beatings ever in the history of modern warfare. Its military might had been destroyed, its infrastructure crushed. Against this backdrop, even as Roosevelt and Churchill offered assurances that German militarism had been permanently dismantled, Herbert W. Armstrong warned of a prophesied revival of German might to be fulfilled in the latter days. "From the very start of World War II," Mr. Armstrong wrote on May 9, 1945, "they have considered the possibility of losing this second round as they did the first, and they have carefully, methodically planned in such eventuality, the third round, World War III. Few could have taken this warning seriously in 1945. Yet today, as Stratford noted in 2010, Germany has become one of the richest, most technologically and industrially advanced states in human history. Just as God said it would be, Germany has risen from the ashes of worldwide war to become the largest, wealthiest, and most powerful state in Europe. It is the beating heart of a revived Holy Roman Empire." For more information about the prophetic rise of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, request our free reprint article, "The Holy Roman Empire is Back."
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
We are fortunate to be living in the most peaceful, most prosperous, most progressive era in human history.
That's a familiar line that President Obama's speechwriters love to put into his speeches as much as possible about how much peace and prosperity there is in the world today. That was from his address in Hanover, the address to the people of Europe. That was yesterday. A couple of days before that, this was when he was still in the UK. He met with a group of young leaders in London, a town hall, it's called, with young leaders of the UK. This was from, as I said, Saturday, April 23rd. And here's what the president said to this group of young leaders.
You know, every few months, I speak with a new group of White House interns. They're roughly your age. They come in for 6 months. They are assigned to various aspects of the White House. And I often talk to them about the fact that if you could choose one moment in history in which to be born, and you didn't know ahead of time what you were to be, you didn't know whether you were a man or a woman, what nationality, what ethnicity, what religion, who your parents were, what class status you might have. If you could choose one time in history where the chances that you led a fulfilling life were most promising, you choose right now, this moment. Because the world, for all of its travails, for all of its challenges, has never been healthier, better educated, wealthier, more tolerant, less violent, more attentive to the rights of all people than it is today.
Now, we've played comments like that for you before on this program, but they're worth repeating from time to time because it's frightening, really. A world leader that really should be up there, not that he shouldn't be a positive man, we all should be, but that should use the platform that he has to make us more aware of the dangers that are looming and the course that this world is on. What a difference there is between that sentiment and the truth of the Bible. It shows, doesn't it, just as bad as this world is getting, it shows how the masterful Satan, the devil, still makes it so alluring, so appealing. The people living in the antediluvian world, days before the flood, well, the Bible says they were just carrying on, eating, drinking, marrying. Life was great. And Jesus says it's going to be just like that in the last days. They had no idea, no clue what was coming until it was finally upon them in Mystery of the Ages. Herbert Armstrong says, thus man has built a man-made and Satan-influenced civilization. Man not only has ruined the earth, he should have developed and improved. He has destroyed his own health by wrong living and degraded and perverted his own spiritual character. Now, at last, as we near the end of the 6,000 years, God has allowed him his free reign. Man has created the Frankenstein of weapons of mass destruction that can destroy all mankind utterly, unless a merciful God intervenes to save us from ourselves. That's just echoing what Jesus said in Matthew 24, that were it not for God's supernatural intervention, there'd be no hope for man. That's the reality of the world today. We have created the Frankenstein monster of weapons of mass destruction. The United States, as I said in the earlier segments, has been partly responsible for creating the Frankenstein monsters that are going to come right back upon us. When you look at what's prophesied to happen in the last days, reaching out to all of these lovers, making peace, quote unquote, with Iran, reaching out to Europe, all of these lovers, forgetting about the old special relationships with Israel, with Britain. We've got new lovers to entertain. We've got new lovers to accommodate. We've got new lovers to help. And God's word says, all your lovers will soon forget you and seek you not. For, as Jeremiah said, I've wounded you with a wound of an enemy, with the chastisement of a cruel one, for the multitude of your iniquity, because your sins were increased. That's really the message that we need to take to Hanover or London or wherever else to prepare people on this world, to prepare them for what's coming. It's certainly not wealthier and more tolerant and less violent than ever. It's about to explode in earth-wide violence. Well, that's about all that we have time for today. We'll carry on our conversation tomorrow. There's a fair bit more here in my notes that I just didn't have time to get to. We're limited to 1 hour, at least for now. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. Don't forget to send us your emails. Send those to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.